Chapter 11. The lie? Other people's kids are so much cleaner, better organized, more polite. I've spoken at my fair share of MOPS groups over the years, and I personally believe there is a special place in heaven for anyone who has lived through the season of raising a preschooler. Like with most talks I'm asked to give, I get the question about what I'd like to speak on when it comes to parenting. Sometimes they even have a theme for me to work with, such as better together or a journey into. On these occasions, I try to work into the theme based on what I know well. A journey into the left side of the Taco Bell menu. A journey into books with a vampire and werewolf love triangle. A journey into finally learning the cha-cha slide to impress your kids just before the whip nene brought you back to square one. Inevitably, I sit down and do my best to work up some thoughtful, poignant discussion based on the proposed theme. A journey into understanding the gospel, perhaps, or a journey into finding peace. But when I try to sit down and write out my thoughts, I can't organize them. Life gets in the way, kids get in the way, work, bedtime, dinner time, nap time, it all gets in the way. I find myself thinking, Lord, how do you expect me to speak about anything if I never get a moment's peace? I'm running around here like my hair is on fire and you're asking me to share wisdom with other women? You want me to talk about my faith? I'm so tired I can't even spell faith. And I hear that still small voice. That is what I want you to speak about. This is probably the impetus for most, if not all, of the things I've ever done that resonated with other women and were therefore successful. I was struggling, and rather than try and sugarcoat it or pretend it wasn't happening, I simply acknowledged my struggles in my work. So I'm not going to talk about finding your peace. I'm going to talk about embracing your chaos. Let's be honest. This is way more likely a scenario because I don't know a woman alive today who can slow down long enough to find her keys, let alone a continuous state of inner peace. If you ever happen to find your peaceful inner bliss while raising children, please don't tell the rest of us. It'll only make us sad, and I eat raw cake batter when I'm sad. I run a lifestyle media company that specializes in creating content for women. The tentpole of that company is the website, and every day a large fan base of ladies from all over the world checks in to figure out what to make for dinner, or how to DIY a throw pillow, or organize their kids for school, or which outfits they should try for fall. I'm reminding you of that so you'll remember that I literally offer women advice for a living. Every single bit of the work I do is created to help make women's lives easier. This is crucial because I'm about to share an entire chapter on running toward chaos, on walking through hard things, on accepting the season you're in, even when it sucks. A decade of doing this job has taught me something, and I have a pretty strong theory. Ironically, I think embracing chaos might be the path to finding peace. Have you ever heard of the chaos theory? Chaos theory is the field of study in mathematics that identifies the behavior and condition of dynamical systems that are highly sensitive to initial conditions, a response popularly referred to as the butterfly effect. FYI, I Googled that. I've never in my life written out a sentence with the words dynamical systems before or since this moment. The butterfly effect is a long ago term based on the idea that if you track the path of a hurricane from its inception, you'd find that it was all caused by a change in air pressure from the flap of a butterfly's wings 3 weeks prior and halfway across the world. In simple terms, it just means that small things can have monstrous effects. Chaos looks like my 3-year-old waking up at least once a night and battling to sleep in our bed, my website crashing and needing hours of repair, my brother-in-law making a trip to the hospital, my husband traveling for 10 days on business, me getting hives or Bell's palsy or stress-induced vertigo, me spilling an entire gallon of milk, a bird pooping in my hair, a baby pooping in my hair, me fighting with my husband, my mom, my sister, or my husband's mom's sister. Y'all can fill in the blank with your own personal brand of chaos because we all have it. Every single one of us is living in chaos, and we handle it in one of three ways. One, we ignore it. This is one of my favorite methods of chaos management. I pretend it isn't there. I keep my head down and keep working harder and harder because nobody can hit a moving target. The problem with ignoring your chaos is that chaos by nature is incredibly stressful. It's like trying to pretend you're not really sick when you clearly have the flu. You can try to mind over matter it, but ultimately, the stress always catches up to you, and your body will react in negative ways. For me, my stress has reacted with Bell's palsy or vertigo. My big sister gets hives when she's stressed out. Another friend gets insomnia. You may think it's not affecting you directly, but it will come out, and likely in ways that aren't healthy for you or your family. Number two, we battle it. Typically, we battle chaos on a completely different field from the one we really need to address. So, in response to our relationships being stressful, we might clean the kitchen. We'll clean the bedroom and the front room. We clean the kitchen again. We brush our kids' hair and wipe their faces and cry when they get ketchup on their church dress. We do everything in our power to have a picture-perfect existence because then, maybe the inside will match the outside. The problem with the battle is that we will always lose. If we believe we can do enough or organize enough or plan enough to make sure that nothing is ever difficult, we will only make ourselves feel like a failure when life is too hard. Life is crazy and stressful, and sometimes it gets worse before it gets better. Losing a battle against regular everyday life makes us feel impotent and angry. It makes us feel out of control. Number three, we drown in it. We get overwhelmed by housework, regular work, family and friends. The stressful things become all we see. It feels insurmountable, and no matter what we do, it doesn't get better. We slip into wallowing. We complain. We crawl under the covers and we let the chaos win. The problem is, drowning means suffocating. And if we choose to stay underwater without kicking our way to the surface, we eventually forget how to swim. Sister, you are stronger than this. You've got babies to raise and bills to pay and a life to live, and you can't do that if you're hiding under the covers. Also, each of these ways, avoiding, battling, and drowning, is a prime platform for the false life preserver of substance abuse. You can use food to avoid facing your life. You can get drunk as a way to drown your sorrows. You can reach for so many negative substances to take your mind away from the chaos around you, and many of us do so without realizing that we're developing a dangerous, regular coping mechanism instead of a one-time escape. The biggest problem with all three of those things, any one of them implies that you are the one in control. And to some extent, that's true. After all, the driving force behind this book is to remind you that you are in control of yourself. But you cannot control the actions of others. Your kids having a meltdown, the baby having a blowout at Target, the dog digging up your yard, or the washing machine breaking down. And when you think you can, you only find yourself angry, frustrated, and stressed. Also, when you assume you're in control, you don't stop and take time to seek out a relationship with God. You use alternative means to try and manufacture some peace. So what are our options? Ignore it, battle it, medicate the chaos until we feel numb to its effects? No way. We are stronger than that. Even if it's hard to feel it when you're buried under a pile of laundry and a horde of hyper children. There is another option. One people rarely cling to. Embrace the madness. Interestingly enough, the people I know who do this best are the ones whose lives are the most chaotic of all. They're my friends whose husbands are serving overseas. They're the women I know who are raising special needs children. They're the single mamas working three jobs. I believe it's because they learned a long time ago that there is beauty in the chaos, as well as freedom in not trying to fight against the tide. The thing is, Jesus was the ultimate embracer of chaos. He preached and taught and shepherded a flock, and in the midst of his tumultuous ministry, he accepted everyone. Everyone was allowed to join in on the love. The widows, the prostitutes, the lepers, the orphans, people with great need, people who brought drama and stress into his life, and folks who weren't always lovable or even kind. Furthermore, Jesus told us to love them too. He didn't ask us kindly or say, "Hey guys, maybe you could..." No, he straight up called us to stand with the oppressed. Jesus looked at them and said, "Bring it on." Jesus took in the messy, broken pieces and said, "Behold, I am making all things new." Amid our chaos, fear, and frustration, there is the reminder, to everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. You're sitting in your house, in your neighborhood, in your city, and thinking, "This is so hard. Nobody else understands. I can't keep up, blah, blah, blah." And God is up there like, "Good and perfect daughter, I have been talking about this since Jump Street." Being overwhelmed isn't a new concept. Having a tough day or week? Do you snap at your husband or want to pull out your hair? You haven't cornered the market on that. You are not the only one. The way you deal with stress, though, is where your individuality comes through. So maybe you're reading this and you're thinking, "Okay, I'm in, I get it. Let's embrace this chaotic life. But how in the heck do I do that?" Start by giving yourself some grace. We all mess up. We all make mistakes. We all forget pajama day or mix it up with picture day. I've screamed at my kids, my husband, and myself. None of it feels good. All of it devastates me because the loss of control is so upsetting. But you know what? Tomorrow is another day and a chance to try again. Take a breath. Find humor in the situation and force yourself to look for it when it's not immediately evident. A couple of years ago, when we were getting certified to be foster parents, a social worker had to interview each of our kids. We sat in the living room with them while she asked innocuous questions over iced tea. She gave them harmless prompts. Harmless until she spoke to a barely 4-year-old Ford Hollis. "What makes you happy?" she asked. He said he liked to go swimming. "And what makes you sad?" she followed up. Without hesitation, he told her, "When Daddy scares me in the night." Both Dave and I froze like deer in headlights. What? What the heck was he talking about? And why was he choosing right now with a social worker from Child Protective Services to work through this? "What do you mean when Daddy scares you in the night?" "You know, when he comes into my room in the night and he's mad at me." Y'all, when you do an interview like this, you're already on edge. But when your kids say something crazy, you think that not only are you not going to get approved for foster care, but also you might lose the children you do have. More questions revealed that Ford was talking about the night before when he'd woken up in the middle of the night and tried to sneak in bed with us, which is against the rules. Daddy was grouchy when he had to walk him back to bed 3 times at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's hilarious in hindsight, but at the time, before we'd gotten clarification, I thought I was going to hyperventilate. So push yourself to laugh at hard situations, In fact, the crazier the situation, the more humor you should be able to mine from it. I also encourage myself and you to look for the fruits of the Spirit. For those of you who didn't grow up singing them on a kid's worship music tape before breakfast each morning like I did, the fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, patience, peace, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. All of these are incredible values, but I believe there's always one that we need the most in a particular season. Choose the one that resonates with you at this moment, write it down on some post-its, and stick them everywhere. Don't forget to take a break. Take care of yourself. Go on a date or get your nails done. Take some time just for you to refill your cup, and you'll be better able to embrace all the badness when you step back inside of it. Find a tribe of people who are in a similar walk of life as you are. Once you find them, be honest about where you're at and what you're struggling with. Learn to ask for help. And when someone offers help, accept it. Accept any and all help you can get and consider it a gift from God. I cannot tell you how many women ask me how I do it all. And when I tell them that I've learned to ask for help, they look at me as if I'm an alien. Like, help with what? For example, when your mother-in-law says she'll come for the afternoon and entertain the kids, say, yes, please. If your husband offers to fold the laundry, even when you don't think he's good at folding towels, say, yes, please. If your girlfriend says she wants to bring you dinner or wine, but you feel badly that you're putting her out, say, yes, please. Or if your elementary school offers afternoon classes that will occupy your rambunctious boys for an additional hour and a half, say, yes, please. What can give you more time, more space, more freedom to find your center? Whatever it is, say yes, please to that. Remember that old joke about how a man keeps praying for God to save him from drowning? Someone comes by in a boat and asks him if he needs a ride, and he's like, nah, God will save me. When it happens two more times, he says the same thing both times. Spoiler alert, the man ends up drowning. And when he gets to heaven, he's like, God, what the heck? I asked you to save me. And God looks at him and says, dude, I sent you 3 different life rafts and you ignored each one. Girlfriend, God is sending you all kinds of life rafts. Some are big and obvious, and some are as simple as the bagger at the store offering to load your groceries into your car. Get in the freaking boat. Remember Philippians 1:6? Being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. Oh man, I just love that scripture. I believe it's true, and I've watched it unfold in my life again and again. You will get through this season. This too shall pass. Don't set the rest of your life up on a downhill slope because of one hard season. It also might be helpful to remember that someone else is praying to have the kind of chaos you're currently crying about. What I mean is, the things you think are so difficult could be someone else's dream come true. I don't say that to make you feel badly or to negate your difficult experience, but perspective may help you see that your chaos is actually just a gigantic blessing. Adjusting your view can work wonders. Lastly, remember the butterfly effect? Well, let's consider an actual butterfly, or more specifically, a caterpillar. Caterpillars are awesome. They have all those legs, and they're really cool, and there's an entire children's book series about how pretty they are. But if the caterpillar just chose to stay a caterpillar, if she decided that the chaos of metamorphosis would be too much for her to handle, she would never know what she could become. Do you think that changing her entire being isn't painful? Do you think it's not scary and hard and overwhelming? Of course it is. But if she didn't fight against the fear, if she didn't allow the change to turn her into her true self, we would never know how beautiful she is. She would never know that she was meant to fly. Things that helped me. Number one, friends like me. Meaning, friends who were newly married when I was newly married. Friends who are entrepreneurs because I'm an entrepreneur. Friends who are working moms or boy moms or have kids at similar ages, they're all lifesavers. Having someone you can grab a glass of wine with who can totally relate to your day is a gift. Such friends are vital in helping me feel encouraged. Number two, priorities. You can keep a clean house or start a company or stay at home with a baby or build a slammin' bod from working out 7 days a week, but I don't think you can have all of those at the same time, or at least not in the same increments. Sit down and decide what's really important to you. Not what's important to your mother-in-law or your girlfriends. Decide what's really important to you. Then do those things first. If the house is cluttered or you need to wait until next year to train for the half marathon, well, that's just life. Number three, boxed wine. Okay, I'm kidding. Well, slightly kidding. I do think you should have something that helps you unwind. Running or watching HGTV or baking might be the thing for you. No matter what, find something in your life that feels like a treat or an indulgence. When you're feeling extra frazzled, you should be able to go to your happy place and reset. Chapter 12. The lie? I need to make myself smaller. I went to a conference last year. The kind of thing where a life guru stands on stage and walks you through guided meditation or yells at you to believe in yourself. I loved every single second of it. As I constantly analyze how I can grow and become a better version of myself, I appreciate wisdom wherever I can get it. No one person can be your source for all the answers, but you can glean a handful of powerful thoughts here and a dash of insight there. I hope you get some great tangible advice from me, but I don't for one moment believe that you're going to take every single thing in these pages as gospel. So, I read the books and listen to the podcast, and when someone I admire fills an arena nearby for a few days of wisdom, you better believe I'm buying a ticket. It was during an experience like this that I had a powerful insight into something about myself I never expected. Which parent did you crave love from more? The speaker asked the crowd. Not which parent did you love more, which one did you crave love from more? My dad. I would assume that this is true for many women, but it's definitely the truth for me. And here's the thing. I've done a lot of therapy, and much of it was so I could walk through questions like this one. So when he asked the audience who we crave love from the most, my answer was, my dad. But I already knew that. No great surprise there. Then he asked the follow-up question that changed everything. And who did you have to be for them? Meaning, what did you believe as a child that you needed to do to receive that parent's love? Successful, I grumbled to myself. This was not news to me. As I've already mentioned, I understood all about how being a performer had affected my life as an adult. Besides that, the man on stage asked, what else did you have to be? Small. It fell out of my mouth without conscious thought. Before that moment, I can tell you I had never, ever considered that concept before. Where did that come from? What did I even mean by it? I sat back in my chair and considered it for the first time in my life. I believe my father was always proud of me, but he wasn't verbal with that praise unless I did something well. As a hard worker himself, he appreciated the achievement. Simultaneously, because he'd never had a great example of what it meant to be a good dad, he had nothing to go by. He had no idea what to do with little kids. My memory is that as children, we understood we should be seen and not heard. I learned quickly not to make a fuss, not to make noise at all if it wasn't what he wanted. Sometimes he wanted to interact. to have conversations or even play, but most of the time, he wanted silence. As I got older, I was aware of the disparity more and more. Little girl. That's what he called me, and not as an endearment. Little girl, you have no clue what you're talking about. Little girl, the world is going to eat you alive. Little girl, you better grow up quick. Little girl became an expletive. I hated when he called me that, but never truly understood how it affected me before that day at the conference. And not just negatively, but positively as well. I wouldn't be who I am were it not for my childhood. I wouldn't be where I am without the work ethic instilled in me by my father. The same man who praised my achievement might have unintentionally taught me to chase it a bit too much. But you can't blame the past for the things that went wrong if you aren't also willing to be thankful for the things that went right. Digging into the whys of how I behave as an adult are what make me able to overcome unhealthy habits. Take, for example, how uncomfortable I used to become when speaking about my job. If you asked me at a party what I did for a living, I'd say something dismissive like, "Oh, I have a lifestyle blog." Never mind the fact that I built a media company from the ground up and manage a staff of 11. Never mind that our clients are some of the biggest brands on earth. Never mind that the website gets millions of visitors a month or that I'm an author and public speaker while also raising babies. It feels boastful to mention those things. It feels like I might make you uncomfortable if I speak about them. A larger part of why I don't want to be boastful is because I learned a long time ago that I was a little girl who had no clue what she was talking about. Being big while also being small is an impossible task for anyone. As I sat at the conference that day, I understood how that dilemma had colored so much of who I had become. As a company, we have been offered so many large opportunities over the last few years, and I'd found one excuse after another to turn them down. I worried that we would disappoint our clients. I worried that we would fail. I worried that I wasn't smart enough to lead the team into new territory. It's hard to write it down now because I spend so much time telling other women to chase their big dreams. And if you had asked me, of course I would have told you that we were daring ourselves to grow by leaps and bounds. But when I took a real look at my life and my company, I recognized the truth. I was making myself small. I was performing just enough to gain your attention, but not truly being myself for fear of what everyone might think of the real me. Who am I really? I'm a wife and a mother, and I also dream of being a true media mogul. I am working to grow my lifestyle media agency to incredible heights. I dream of having enough revenue so that all of these incredible people who work for me, who took a chance on helping with my dream, can own their own homes, pay off their student loans, and take long, dreamy vacations somewhere sunny. I dream of starting a nonprofit that supports other women who want to chase down dreams of their own. I'm working to build a company my children will grow up and work at too. I think the media we consume can positively impact our lives, and by creating media that uplifts and encourages women, we can literally change the world. I have so many goals and dreams for myself, and not one of them is small. They're big and wild and full of hope. They require faith and courage and a whole lot of audacity. I cannot get there. I will not get there unless I start embracing every side of my character, including the sides of me that make other people uncomfortable. This is what occurred to me at the conference that day. I cannot continue to live as half of myself simply because it's hard for others to handle all of me. I was at another conference just a few weeks ago when I saw this playing out in other women around me. 400 inspiring, entrepreneurial-minded women, and I kept hearing them saying the same things over and over. Well, this is just my hobby. This is just something I do on the side. My job is being a mom, but this is a great side gig. Y'all, these were not women casually selling antiques from their garage on Etsy. These women were running businesses and teams. Some of them were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, yet I heard the word hobby over and over. It made me realize I am not the only woman who is making herself small to make others feel more comfortable. It's hard for people who don't understand us to be fully supportive. When you boil it down, that's the heart of the problem with my father. He couldn't understand what to do with a small child, let alone a girl. Since he didn't understand me, he often unintentionally muted the parts of me that made him uncomfortable. Working women sometimes have to fight their way through patriarchal systems. Working mothers get backlash from in-laws or parents who can't understand our desire to work, while stay-at-home moms slam us for being away from our children. I'll bet stay-at-home moms feel similarly judged by working women who can't relate to their life choices. It's as though we're all children on the playground trying to say whatever others want to hear, trying to hide all the parts that others might not understand. It makes me wonder how many women are walking around living into half their personality and in doing so, denying who their creator made them to be. Do you really think God made you, uniquely wonderful you, in the hopes you would deny your true self because it might be off-putting to others? I can't believe that's true. The more I've thought about it, the more I believe that God made me this way. He knew I would have a worker's heart, and He knew I would want to build big dreams. In the same way, He knew another one of His children was meant to stay home and raise her beautiful babies, while another daughter of His wouldn't want to have kids at all. Have you spent a lifetime muting yourself for fear of what others will think? Are you an entrepreneur who calls your business a hobby because you worry about what your mother-in-law will say, or because it's safer to keep everyone's expectations low? Are you hesitating to go back to school because you think you're not smart enough? Do you stop yourself from daring to try something new because you're already positive you'll fail? Do you remain silent when you have so much to say? Do you believe you'll never do better or be better than you are right now because of your family of origin? Do you hesitate to admit your dreams aloud because you're nervous about others making fun of you or judging you for your choices? Girl, I lived in fear of this for years. I worried that if you knew how much I loved to work, you might call into question how I can do any of those things while being a successful mother. I've had too many people question my commitment to my children over the last 10 years, and it influenced what I came to believe about being a working woman. It was a long battle from mommy guilt to acceptance, and I was only ever able to work through it after we adopted our daughter. When she was about 6 weeks old, I had to go on a business trip. And while I was gone, someone asked me about mommy guilt as a working mom. It's a question that comes up a lot, and one that I bet most mothers, regardless of whether they stay home with their babies or choose to work, have grappled with. I've thought about it a lot over the last 10 years of motherhood, and even more so now that I'm raising a daughter. And here's what I've decided. I refuse to teach her this narrative. I absolutely refuse to raise her with the ideal that only one parent is ultimately responsible for who she will become. I was raised by two working parents and the proverbial village. I will not consent to the belief that having a mother with a full-time job means that she's not loved and well cared for. I will not set her up to believe that having a career or not has anything to do with how much she's committed to her partner or how much she loves her children, should she choose to have either. I will not tell her that a man's work is only out in the world or that a woman's work is inside the home. If she chooses to stay at home, then we will support her with all our hearts, but we will never teach her that there's only one kind of woman to be. This is important. because her brothers will be told by society that their options are endless. And she will be shown by media that her world is limited. I know this for many reasons, but mostly because her daddy has never one time been asked if he feels guilty for having a job. As she grows, my daughter will learn things out in the world that I wish she didn't. I cannot control that. But I can control the kind of woman I set as an example. I, her mother, believe that Noah, my daughter, is fearfully and wonderfully made by a God who imagined her place in this world long before either of us was born. I believe the same thing about you. I believe that you are not a mistake, and feeling guilt about who you are, working, staying at home, overweight, underweight, overeducated, uneducated, emotional, bookish, street smart, or whatever, does a disservice to yourself and the Creator who made you. There are hundreds of ways to lose yourself, but the easiest of them all is refusing to acknowledge who you truly are in the first place. You, the real you, is not an accident. Those dreams you have for yourself are not silly. They are the roadmap to your divine calling. Don't sit this one out. Don't let someone else's opinion of you determine your worth. Don't miss out on the chance to live the life of incredible possibility in front of you. You were not made to be small. You are not a little girl. You are a grown woman, and it's time you grew up. Become exactly who God calls you to be. Things that helped me. Number one, a willingness to offend. I don't mean offend as in tell a bunch of yo mama jokes. I mean embrace the idea that not everyone can understand or approve of you, including those closest to you. If you're a people pleaser like I was, this is especially hard because my instinct is to ensure that everyone likes me at all times. So, I decided to get out of my own way and stop focusing so much on what anyone else thought. I focus on being the best, most loving version of myself, but whether or not you approve of that isn't my concern. Number two, a bold statement. For me, it was a tattoo. I'd secretly wanted one for years, but I was worried about what others would think. Then I had an epiphany. I get to decide who I am. Every single day we're alive, we're choosing this life and this persona. We choose to be the stay-at-home mom who loves baking and Pilates. We choose to be a hipster who loves coffee shops and artisan goods. We choose to be a lawyer who runs marathons and only eats organic. Every single aspect of our persona, no matter how long we've rocked it, is a choice we make every day. This was a massive eye-opener for me, and as odd as it sounds, when I realized this, it hit me right between the eyes, and the very first thought I had was, I'm getting a wrist tattoo. Number three, an encounter with a guru. Many times, I need the insight of a podcast, a book, or a conference to gain perspective. If you wonder if you are muting a side of yourself or there are things you know you want to work on, start consuming content that speaks to that specific area. You may not adopt every word of what you hear or read, but you'll certainly garner a bit of wisdom to help you with your season. Chapter 13. The Lie. I'm going to marry Matt Damon. Laugh all you want, but this was something I believed for years. I've talked about my obsession with Matt Damon many times, mostly because it's funny, and I live to make other people chuckle. It's also an easy laugh because people have a hard time reconciling a seemingly intelligent, sane person believing that she will marry a celebrity she's never met. But the truth is, there was a time, whole years of my life, in fact, when my greatest life plan was to find Matt Damon somewhere in LA and lock it in. I spent most of my junior year in high school watching Good Will Hunting over and over. I can still recite the entire movie for you by heart if you need me to. I applied over and over again for jobs at Miramax Films because they had produced Good Will Hunting, and my 18-year-old brain assumed that Matt Damon might stroll through the lobby at any given moment. For my last year living at home and my first year in Los Angeles, this fantasy of Matt as my knight in shining armor kept me going. I imagined it in vivid detail. How we'd meet, what I'd wear, where we'd marry, what our house would look like, what our kids would look like. When I found myself in a bleak place, those imaginings were the light at the end of my tunnel. I truly believed they were where I was headed. When I finally did bump into Matt while working a party for Miramax a year into working there, he walked right toward me at the back of the theater. I mean, hand to dog, he made a beeline for where I was standing. My heart nearly exploded in my chest because it was happening exactly the way I thought it would. He saw me and somehow just knew we were destined to be together. As soon as he got within earshot, he started to speak. "Excuse me," he said. "This is it," I thought. "Do you know where I'm supposed to sit?" He spoke to me because he was a celebrity and I was the girl with the clipboard in her hands, not because he sensed we were destined to be together. I walked him to his assigned spot and left him there without a marriage proposal or even a request for a date. After living in LA for a year, enough reality had hit me to understand that my former imaginings were part of a childish daydream. Later on in life, I had another fantasy. This one was smaller, the outcome less life-altering, but I obsessed about it just as much. I wanted a Louis Vuitton bag. More specifically, I wanted a Louis Vuitton Speedy bag. For those of you who aren't familiar, it's one of LV's classics. It's about the size of a regulation football, and at the time, they cost a little over $1,000. $1,000 for a bag the size of my head. It was ridiculous, but I still wanted it. I wanted it because it represented the kind of woman I dreamed of becoming. During my first summer living in LA, I often visited the Beverly Center. The Beverly Center is a fancy pants mall in Beverly Hills, and at the time, I couldn't afford anything other than the $6 it took me to park there. Even still, I would wander around window shopping and dreaming of someday. It was on one such trip when I saw the most glamorous woman I had ever seen. Or at least, the epitome of what I hoped to look like someday. Her hair was glossy, her makeup was perfect, her outfit was cute, and in her hand she carried a Louis Vuitton Speedy bag. Even better, she tied a vintage scarf around the handle of that bag, making it the classiest looking thing I'd ever witnessed in real life. In that moment, I was sold on this ideal. Someday, I was going to be as pulled together and stylish as that woman. Someday, I was going to own that bag. I coveted it for years, knowing it was a total fantasy. $1,000 is an astronomical sum to spend on something so frivolous. But I still imagined what I'd do with that bag. I imagined where I'd use it and how I'd change out the scarf seasonally to match my outfit. I pictured it in great detail, and over time, I came up with a game plan for achieving it. Someday, I would build a company, and someday that company would have real clients who would pay me really big money. The first time someone gave me a check for $10,000 in consultation fees, I decided I was going to buy myself that bag. It took me years, you guys. Years of scraping and hustling as a small-time wedding planner. Years of building up my portfolio of work and my client roster. Years of charging $750, then $1,000, then more. Every time I went to the mall, I'd walk by Louis Vuitton and stare at that bag through the window. Through every meeting and contract, I held on to that vision. For every mean bridezilla or drunk best man speech or late night cleaning confetti out of the hotel carpet so my clients wouldn't lose their deposit, I kept thinking, I am going to get that speedy bag. The day I received my first $10,000 check, I drove directly to the bank, and then from the bank to the Louis Vuitton store at the Beverly Center. When I walked out of that store, it was the proudest I'd ever been in my whole life. A purse is cool, and a Matt Damon obsession is, interesting, perhaps. But why bring them up now? Why tell you about this random, quirky lie or this purse I used to be obsessed with when the other chapters carry so much weight and seriousness? Because I think my ability to imagine my dreams in intricate detail is one of the biggest reasons I've been able to achieve them. Seriously. Don't rush by that statement. Sit with it for a minute. A huge part of my success is built into my imagination. And I don't mean Tim Burton-style imagination. I just mean the ability to pick out a daydream and then focus on it, sometimes for years. One of the questions I get most often is how I stay motivated. Lately, I've been trying to offer tangible ideas. Surround yourself with inspiring people, both in real life and in your social media feeds. Listen to motivational podcasts. Blast pump-up jams until you're feeling inspired. Figure out a formula for what motivates you, then do it again and again. But that may sound like advice you've probably heard before. So what's the point of repeating information that won't stick? I'd rather hone in on what's going to make the big difference for you, even if it might sound a little strange. For me, the big difference was envisioning a very specific future. Believing I would marry Matt Damon was borderline crazy, but it got me to LA, and it led me to fighting for getting a job at Miramax Films, which led me to both my career as an event planner and my future husband. In the absence of clear direction or real vision, I just imagined one. I latched on to the idea of a future so I knew a direction to walk in. Along the way, I grew up and learned about my destination, but had I not held that idea in my head, who knows where I would have gone? Or more importantly, how I would have mentally escaped the hard times while I was still inside of them. When I was dreaming about that purse, my larger goals of making a decent salary and contributing to the bank account I shared with my new husband seemed overwhelming. They didn't feel tangible. But breaking it down into a bite-sized goal, in my case, buying a purse, was achievable. Calling your shot is powerful when you're chasing down a dream, but it's also not enough. You have to spend real time focusing on everything you can about that dream. What does it look like? What does it feel like? How much detail can you imagine? How real can you make it in your own mind? Because here's the deal. My goals are real to me. There isn't a single doubt or a question in my mind that I can achieve them. I have absolute certainty. The same way I did with Matt or that ridiculously expensive handbag. Whether or not the dream ultimately comes true isn't the point. The point is, how do you steer your ship in a clear direction? How do you stay on course even when the water is choppy or the boat is crashing on the rocks? You do that by keeping your eyes on the horizon. For me, my daydreams were an attempt to keep my eyes above the waves. When life was hard and murky and difficult to navigate, having a clear vision gave me something to focus on. I can't recommend it enough for you. Do you have a goal for yourself? I'll tell you again, write it down. No, seriously, write it down. Imagine it in intricate detail. Focus on it whenever you can. What will it feel like to get healthy? How will your clothes fit? Or how about your dream job? What will your first day at that company be like? How about the 50th? What will you be able to do in your free time because you have that position? How much happier will you be? I like visuals as well. I keep my visual reminders of my current goals taped up inside my closet, so every single time I get dressed, which is daily, yo. I see them as a reminder. What are they? I knew you'd ask. One is the cover of Forbes with the top female self-made millionaires. The second is a picture of a vacation home in Hawaii. Both have been on my wish list for years. The house in particular feels extra dreamy but hard to achieve. My goal is to own it by the time I'm 40. So I've got 5 years. You guys, I can't tell you how often I've felt tired or discouraged or whatever, and I've closed my eyes and imagined my 40th birthday party at that house in Hawaii that I've dreamed up. My friends, my kids, my husband, and my family are there, and we're all drinking some fabulous cocktail. I'm wearing a gorgeous caftan of some kind, because when you make enough money to buy your own Hawaiian vacation home, you can wear whatever you want, and there's no way I'm restricting my midsection. That birthday party and that house are crystal clear in my mind. They help me focus when I get bogged down. Sometimes these daydreams work as a distraction technique too. When I'm running long distance or training for a race, my imagination is a stellar tool for focusing on something else. Back when I trained for my first half marathon, my only goal was just to finish without dying. The next time around, the goal was to run those 13 miles faster than I did the time before. That meant training often and well, doing long runs and tempo runs and pushing myself each time. It's hard, y'all, and it hurt muscles I hadn't used since I did step aerobics back in the 90s. When I run, I use this trick for getting through any strenuous workout, and you're free to use it too. It's utterly ridiculous and even a little embarrassing, but it works for me every time. I believe Mindy Kaling coins the phrase cardio fantasies, how she invents stories to entertain herself as she exercises. If she didn't, someone please trademark that for me and I'll turn it into my next book and a line of activewear. My cardio fantasy is the big, crazy dream I typically imagine myself in during a particularly difficult workout. Sometimes the music in my headphones can get me through, but when the going gets tough, the tough, that's me in this scenario, imagines herself vacationing with George Clooney at his house in Lake Como. Laugh at me all you want, but I've found that the more outlandish the cardio fantasy, the more time I can pass without noticing that my quads are screaming. Don't have your own cardio fantasy? Borrow one of mine. These are, no, seriously, my go-tos. You think I'm trying to be funny here, but I swear by the power of Grayskull, these are really what I'm thinking about. Be friends with your hero. As you may or may not know, I am the biggest book nerd you've ever met in your whole life. Don't even start a book conversation with me unless you really want to take it to level 5, because I will embarrass myself. There's no author on earth I want to meet more than Deborah Harkness. Because I'm a super nerd, I also know that she lives relatively nearish my weekly running spot. I like to imagine a detailed scenario where she's on the same trail I am and I recognize her and we basically become best friends and we meet weekly to walk and discuss the intricate plot points of her next book. Vacationing with celebrities. I wasn't kidding about the George Clooney thing. I like to imagine I'm part of a large collection of celebrity couples and we're all vacationing somewhere amazing. In the same scenario, my hair is always shiny and my makeup a dewy, J-Lo-like special. I make everyone dinner and surprisingly, even the super skinny movie stars like meatloaf and casseroles. They ask where they can get my cookbook and they all love me because for a billionaire media mogul, I'm surprisingly down to earth. Singing on stage with Lionel Richie. I have a lot of Lionel Richie on my iPod, so this was sort of a forced fantasy. At some big birthday party of mine, that 40th in Hawaii, let's say, Lionel is a longtime family friend who surprises me by coming to perform. At some point, he pulls me on stage and we sing together. I can't actually sing well in real life, but in this scenario, I crush dancing on the ceiling. Later, as an encore, we do a haunting duet of Hello, and years later, friends will still recall, "Geez, Rachel, Do you remember that one time you and Lionel sang Hello? Ryan Gosling or a Hemsworth brother, I am far too much of a weenie to have any real fantasies about these guys, but I do like dreaming about some situation where I look flawless and am so totally hilarious and witty that one of these stallions can't help but hit on me. Propriety forces me to tell Ryan/Chris/Liam that I'm happily married, but the dream of them asking will still be with me when I'm 90 years old. Some fantasies are instrumental in helping us to reach our goals. Some fantasies are silly, but they give us something to think about. If you ask me, all of them have value, and your fantasies will be different from mine. Maybe you cure a rare disease or have dinner with Oprah. Maybe you talk politics with Roosevelt or try on dresses with Edith Head. The point is, you don't think about the challenge before you. You keep your eyes above the waves. So stop laughing at my nerdiness and find whatever motivation you need to get out there today and make some moves. Things that helped me. Number one, writing it down. I cannot stress this enough. When it comes to goal setting, it's imperative that you write everything down. Okay, maybe not your Matt Damon related goals. I was a teenager, you guys. But if you're dreaming of something for yourself, physically writing down the words is a powerful thing to do. Number two, saying it out loud. Naming your goals is also important because often we struggle to even admit them to ourselves. Make sure when you name yours, you do it in a powerful way. Say, I am getting my master's in organizational psychology, instead of, I will try to go back to school. I drive around town saying my goals in my car where no one can hear me. I announce them like proclamations, as if it's only a matter of time before they happen. Number three, creating a vision board. The pictures inside my closet hold a lot of meaning for me. They're a constant reminder of where I want to go, and a visual aid can be really helpful for those of you who don't feel like your imagination is strong. Use someone else's visuals to help you map out your dreams in your mind. Chapter 14. The lie? I'm a terrible writer. After I published my first book, Party Girl, I would occasionally, read every 11 seconds, check Goodreads to see what people were saying about it. As a massive book nerd who devours online reviews in order to build my TBR pile, it felt so exciting to read other people's reviews of a book I had written. It was such an incredible boost for me, especially as I fought my way through writing the sequel, to see the lovely things readers were saying. I was driven to tears more than once by some sweet fan explaining exactly why she loved my characters, all as I'm thinking, yes, that is exactly what I hoped you'd see in her. I lived in this dream world for months. I honestly didn't even know any other reality existed. Then one day, it suddenly ended. I got my first bad review. It's hard to explain exactly how it felt to see someone giving my work 2 stars. But I liken it to being punched in the stomach, then the face, then the stomach again. I entered the early stages of what I like to call critique grief. The first is, obviously, denial. I read her review, and then I read it again. Turns out, no matter how many times I read it, she still thought my work was trite and ridiculous. Next up, in real life grief stages, it would be anger. But for critique grief, at least for me, believing the bad stuff was so much easier than believing the good. Nah, no anger for me. I went right on to bargaining. The first idea in my people-pleasing brain was to comment and try to get her to understand my intentions with the work. Better yet, maybe I could find a way to befriend her. Because surely if we became social media acquaintances and then social media besties, then she would know me and therefore better understand my writing. Surely then she wouldn't have disliked it quite so much. I felt sick to my stomach as I slipped into the last stage of critique grief, acceptance. I decided if this unknown woman was right, maybe everyone else was too easy on my book because it was a debut novel. Maybe this one person was a better judge and I was, in fact, a terrible writer. I was spiraling. In the midst of it, I heard that little voice in my head that helps me out in times of crazy. No, not God, or Jiminy Cricket, or even my inner self. The voice in my head is my therapist, Denise. God bless her. Years ago, Denise told a younger, much more anxiety-ridden me, "Someone else's opinion of you is none of your business." Let me say that again for the people in the cheap seats. Someone else's opinion of me is none of my business. Someone else's opinion of you is none of your business. Those words are so powerful for anyone who tends to hold other people's opinions ahead of their own. And they are never more profound than when we're creating something. Maybe it's a book, a blog, a company, a piece of art, or your fashion sense. When you're creating something from your heart, you do it because you can't not do it. You produce it because you believe your creation deserves to be out in the world. You work and work, and then you close your eyes and cross your fingers and hope it finds recognition. But here's the thing about that magical, mystical thing you're making. You create it because you have a God-given ability to do so. You create as a gift to yourself and to the higher power who blessed you with those abilities. But you can't make people like or understand it. You have to be willing to put it out there, even if they don't like it, even if they hate it, even if they give you 2 stars or none at all. You have to understand that every person on earth has an opinion, and their opinion, even if they're the most widely recognized expert on the subject, only has bearing on your work if you let it. A mean review cannot make me a bad writer. Can I write terribly? Oh, heck yes. The first, second, and third draft of everything I write is basically garbage. If I refuse to take constructive criticism from an editor I trust, if I don't push myself to grow as a writer, if I regurgitate the same story over and over, or worse, if I try to impersonate someone else's style, then yes, there is a good chance my work is going to suck. But deciding that something is bad simply because other people don't like or understand it is not a theory I can co-sign. Art and creativity are so subjective, and dang it, it's hard to find the courage and drive to complete anything. So sister, if you're going to work that hard on a project, do you really want to allow it to be blown apart by something as flimsy as an opinion? As an artist or creator, you have to decide. You have to choose a path or live the rest of your life slowly killing your ability to do great work for fear of what others will think. You have to decide that you care more about creating your magic and pushing it out into the world than you do about how it will be received. This task is much easier said than done. As I sit writing this chapter in my favorite local coffee shop, I've checked my other browser approximately 30 times. This morning, I posted an article on a website I've contributed to for years. But today, I decided to talk about something a tad bit controversial. At least, it's outside of the kind of post I'm typically known for. And so I'm wondering, will anyone get it? Will it find a home and an audience? Or worse yet, will it make anyone mad? Even after years of putting myself out there, I still get caught up in the lie that I might be a terrible writer or that I should create or not based on whether I have an audience for it. I start to believe that I need public opinion to validate my desire to make something, when the truth is I should embrace my creativity because it's a God-given ability. Anytime I try something new, I will have to fight off the desire to confirm that it will be loved in order to keep going. Since I anticipate being creative and trying new things for as long as I'm living, that could mean decades of occasionally being trapped by unhelpful anxieties. What a waste of energy. Would I rather bottle up my creative thoughts and ideas? No. I hope they find a home, even if they only resonate with a handful of people. So then I have to ask myself if I would be willing to risk a negative response if my work resonated positively with others. What if only one person gets it, but everyone else hates it? What if nobody loves it at all? Would it be worth it even then? Yes. My answer is yes. I would rather put my work out there, no matter what the response will be. I would rather create in celebration of the fact that I have the ability to do so. For me, the answer is to create. That is always the answer. My personal form of creation is writing, especially writing words I hope other people will read. So I have two choices. I can write down words and send them out into the world and hope they find a home. Or I can hide my light under a bushel because I'm too afraid someone won't like the glare. I choose this. I choose to sit in coffee shops and on airplanes and at my kitchen counter writing. I choose to squeeze in minutes between soccer practice or before sunrise or long after everyone else in the house is asleep to type and type and type until I stream enough sentences together to make a book. I have no idea if you'll love it or hate it. Obviously, I hope you dig the heck out of it and buy 100 copies for all your friends. But even if you don't, I'll still be here. I started at this desk alone, without an audience to read my work. I'll stay here as long as I've got words jumbling around in my head, whether or not there's anyone to receive them. When I was a little girl, I spent every Sunday, and most other days, at the small First Assembly of God church where my daddy was the pastor. Our song service included Mama on the piano and a handful of tambourines sprinkled throughout the room. We were simultaneously off-key and in three-part harmony in a way only a small country church can pull off. As I got older, I experienced the sedate musicality of a large Presbyterian congregation, the joy of an inner-city gospel choir, and the theatrics of a megachurch. I've been to tiny prayer meetings in Ethiopia where I couldn't understand a single word but felt every one of them. I've spent hours upon hours of my life singing and clapping in church, and this is what I've come to discover. Writing, for me, is its own kind of worship. The definition of worship is the feeling of expression or reverence for a deity. Creating is the greatest expression of reverence I can think of because I recognize that the desire to make something is a gift from God. The freedom to carve out the time and have a safe place to create that art is a blessing of the highest level in a world where so many people are unable to have either. Every time I indulge in the art of creation without worrying about what the public will think of it, is craft in its purest form. And craft can be any old thing at all. For me, it's writing. For you, it might be painting, making quilts, or taking a Thursday night ballet class. Whether or not something is good or worthy is up for interpretation. And if you're unconcerned about other people's interpretation, then everything you make is fantastic. I hope you'll remember this in your own life, and I hope you'll create for yourself. Do it in celebration of your ability to do so, regardless of what anyone else thinks. Things that helped me. Number one, I stopped reading reviews. This is a big deal, you guys. I have no idea what you think of anything I've written since that bad review on Party Girl so many years ago. Maybe you love my books. Maybe you use them for kindling. Either way, it doesn't affect my desire to keep writing more. Everyone gets reviewed. even if you're just asking for the opinion of your judgmental sister and being torn apart by her response. Do something daring this year and stop reading your version of reviews. Number two, I write for myself. I write fiction about girls falling in love in Los Angeles. I write cookbooks about cheese-based dips. Now, here I am writing a nonfiction book about the struggles and triumphs in my life. This makes no earthly sense. Authors write in one or two genres, and they build up clout in a handful of areas. Here's the bottom line. Writing is my art, my creative outlet. It is literally my lifelong dream come true, and therefore, I hold it sacred. It never has been and never will be my job. I don't need it to make money to be valuable. This is an important distinction for me because I never want the creative choices I'm making to be based on money or business rather than whatever is on my heart and in my head. If you have it within your power to keep a piece of your creativity just for yourself, it is truly a gift. Number three, I indulge in silliness. I color with my boys, I draw on the ground with sidewalk chalk, I watch YouTube videos about how to do shimmery, smoky eyes, and try to replicate it even if I have nowhere to go. I reach for silly, creative endeavors that serve no real purpose other than joy.